When time ran out last week, we were in 2 Samuel 3 at verse 23. And we've gotten to the point where Joab comes back after Abner, the captain of the northern tribes formerly, has just left, and Joab is rather upset. Verse 23 says, when Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace. Then Joab went to the king and said, what have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he has gone? You know that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, and to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you're doing. Now, what do you see on Abner, on Joab's part, as far as his attitude is concerned, in those words from verses 23 to 25? How would you summarize Joab's intent and his attitude?
Very negative towards Abner for possibly many reasons. Perhaps his brother, who is now dead. Also, the fighting between the two. Mm-hmm. And secure his own position.
Oh, that nails it. 1, 2, 3. Anybody else? He can't say anything good about him. And you notice even the way he words it. He comes and he's told that, and I suspect the person who tells him had a reason for telling it, and he probably has the same motive or similar motive that Joab does. But Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and listen to the next words. And he let him go. He doesn't say, he came and it was good, and he went away in peace, and things are going to be well. He says, and he let him go. Which implies he did a bad. So that stirs him up a little. He's gone in peace, implying that a man like Abner did not deserve to go away in peace. So in verse 24, 2 Samuel 3, 24, then Joab goes to the king and says, what have you done? He's already stirred up against Abner. He's wanted to kill him already. And now he comes in and berates David. What have you done? Abner came to you. He was in your hand. He came to you. You didn't have to go out looking for him to kill him. He gave himself up, as it were. Why did you send him away so now he's gone? You let the prey get away. You know that he came to deceive you. You know that he came to know about what you're doing. He's spying on you. He is looking at your movements. He's looking at your plans. He's trying to figure those out. He knows you're going out and you're coming in. Abner has been the enemy in the past, hasn't he? He's the one who suggested that the children of Israel and the children of Judah play with one another, and so the dozen are dead on both sides. He's tried to kill Joab's soldiers when the war broke out, the civil war at that point, or at least that was a battle of it. Every soldier knows that releasing an enemy doesn't take care of the problem, at least not typically. It gives him an opportunity to attack again. Whether Abner would have attacked at all, we don't know. But Joab's thinking not just as a soldier, but as a man who is filled with vengeance. And so he's afraid, in part, as David said, that Abner may replace him as general of Judah's army. Imagine this. Abner comes to David and he says, you know, I think I can bring all the 10 northern tribes under your tent. You'll be the king of all Israel. Now, what can you do for me? Well, he's a military man. What might David do for him to make sure he secures this position as king over all 12 tribes? He could say, well, I'd make you chief of the army. I'll put you in the place where Joab is now for the tribe of Judah. So, later on, in chapter 20, verse 10, Joab will kill Amasa when Joab's been replaced. He's been booted after the death of David's son. He's been booted. Amasa's been put in his place. He does him the same way he does Abner. He kills him. So, here in verse 3, Joab is a man with a mission. Let me see if I can summarize what's going on with Joab. And you can probably think of several other things, but he has a grudge. He never forgets the wrong of an enemy. He's like an elephant. They say an elephant remembers a wrong time. Anybody remember that? But I suspect that's true. He has a jealous streak. He will brook no rivals, whether it's Abner or Amasa or whoever. He has ambitions. Joab can't be king, but he can be right up there next to him. He can, in fact, be the strings behind the king to pull this puppet in the direction he wants him to go. And you see him doing some of that as time goes on. So he takes matters more than once into his own hands. He has suspicions. He puts the worst constructions on Abner's conduct. He has to assume the worst. Three things about this. Abner, he thinks, has murdered his brother. What's wrong with that accusation? It was during a battle. It's time of war. Joab is judging Abner by himself. It's what he would do. Then number two, Abner's trying to nudge him out of his position. And if Abner's reconciled to David, Joab's job is in jeopardy. So the accusations, he accuses Abner of being a double agent in all effects here. Verse 25, he came to deceive you. He's not going to bring Israel under your hand. He's going to kill you, then he's going to rule all 12. You can't trust this man. Joab is actually the man who is full of accusations and deceit here because he's out to kill Abner. And then the temper of Joab. While he's out fighting for Israel and gathering spoils, here David and Abner are having a royal banquet, possibly with a view toward putting him aside and putting Abner in his place. So Joab's just not appreciated. That adds fuel to the fire. And then he has some self-deception going on. Even if he convinces himself that he's acting on David's behalf and in his best interest, deep down he has to know the truth. And that'll come out in verses 25 and 30. He also talks here about your going out and your coming in. He has come here for the purpose of learning about your going out and your coming in. Now, what does that mean? That's an expression you'll see throughout the Bible. Very quickly, Deuteronomy 28:6. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. What is God saying when He gave His people that promise? You'll be blessed when you come in, and blessed when you go out. What does that mean? That's all the time. You're either going in or coming out all day, every day, right? Also, Psalm 121:8. The Lord shall preserve your going out, your coming in from this time forth and even forevermore. What's that saying? Permanent security. Acts 1:21 in the New Testament. Therefore, these men who have accompanied us all the time that the Lord went in and out among us. There has to be somebody chosen to be an apostle to replace Judas who was with us while the Lord was going out and coming in among us. The Lord went out and came in. Acts 9:28. So he was with them at Jerusalem, Paul was, coming in and going out. It's a Semitic idiom that basically means to live. They use an idiom sometimes for walking. The Jews use one for sitting. Where do you sit? I sit over here in the city. Where do you sit? They had one for walking. Walking is what you do in the place where you are. And they also had one for going in and coming out. So that idiom refers to how David lives. Here it's referring to what Abner is going to see about the way David lives with the possible accusation or implication of an assassination. Now, in verse 26, when Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner. And they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah, but David did not know about it. So Joab takes matters into his own hands. He does not consult David first. He doesn't say, send me after him and I'll kill this dog and we won't have to worry about Abner anymore. David wants Abner to live. He does it behind David's back. He goes against the wishes of his commanding officer, the king. The cistern of Sirah is about 2.5 miles from Hebron, so it's a city of refuge, Hebron is. And so he's about 2.5 miles down the road. And in verse 27, when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. Keep this in mind. You're going to see this again in chapter 20. I need to tell you something. So they go aside, and there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. There specifically stating that his real motive is vengeance over killing his brother, which was an act of self-defense in a time of war. Now, Joab's murder occurs in Hebron. You know anything about Hebron? What kind of city it was? It is a city of refuge. You're not supposed to kill your enemy in a city of refuge. He comes within the gate. Asahel died in war, not in premeditated murder. That's quite a difference in the two means of the revenge that's going on here. The revenge is not permitted in a city of refuge. Ironically, Joab's the murderer and not Abner when all is said and done. So verse 28, afterward, it tells us when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner the son of Ner. Now listen then to what he says. He says, I'm innocent, my kingdom, my rule. We had nothing to do with this. Then he turns it. Verse 29. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house. And may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge or who is leprous or who holds a spindle or who falls by the sword or who lacks bread. That's a fivefold imprecation, meaning may this happen to Joab and all of his family. More about that in just a moment. So Joab and Abishai, verse 30, his brother killed Abner. Notice, Joab and Abishai killed him. Did Abishai actually stand there when they stepped aside at the gate and plunge a knife into him as well? Or was it just that he was in on the plot? I don't know. It doesn't really matter. They both are involved. Both would have done it. And the reason is because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle. Notice it emphasizes in a battle at Gibeon. In verse 29, notice David's curse on Joab proves that Joab was not justified as a kinsman redeemer because one of his loved ones had been unjustly slain by someone who had a grudge against him. In fact, Abner tried all he could to keep from killing him. This is the going out part. Now, the discharge that he talks about here. That's when a person loses his fluids, he loses his weight, he looks terrible, he wastes away. Leviticus 15:2, when a person has a discharge, he's excluded from worship. Leviticus 15:31, he has to bring sacrifices once he gets cleansed. The leprous, that's virtually a death sentence, and it's virtual isolation. You're out by yourself, and you cover your lip, and you say, unclean, unclean, anytime someone comes within a certain distance of you. Let your people be those who hold a spindle. A spindle being a long stick that a person would support himself with, either because he has a bad leg and he can't walk or because he's so weak. People will use a cane in a similar way. They'll use a cane when they're very weak and they need that third leg because the two he has are pretty shaky. So the arm kind of supports the other two. Or because his leg is so injured, one works not very well, but it works. The other one doesn't work much at all, and so the cane, or the crutch, we would say, helps supply that ability. And then may he fall by the sword. Interestingly, in 1 Kings 2, that's what's going to happen to Joab himself. And you studied Benaiah a couple weeks ago and saw how that occurred. And then may there also not be one who escapes lacking bread, referring to a loaf of bread. May Joab die, that's the sword part. May Joab starve to death, that's the bread part. So David is saying, I hope, I pray that these things come upon you because this is what you deserve because of what you've done. This in lieu of what David could have done. What does David not do? Execute him. Should he have executed him? How do we know? We can know that. What does David tell Solomon to tell Benaiah to do? Kill him. And you remember studying that a couple weeks ago? That's 1 Kings 2. So, 1 and 2. So, here you have Joab's condition. He looks like the winner. He thinks he's won. He's gotten his revenge. If I'd heard this kind of imprecation from a godly man and realized that somebody's out there laying for me, and if nobody else, it's God himself, I wouldn't feel too good about it. But he's not through with his ruthless career. Any comments before we go on? Okay, verse 31. Then David said to Joab and all the people who were with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David followed the bier. Meaning it's mostly like not a casket as we use it typically, but many times a board or something like that. Here is forced morning. Now, that was not that unusual in Palestine. The people who were mourning for Jairus' daughter start laughing out of ridicule when Jesus suggests she's not really dead. They weren't really mourning. They were hired mourners. You had those a couple of times in Jeremiah. It speaks about people who are hired to mourn. They're skilled at lamentation. They can cry and cause others to burst into tears. And this is the time to show that kind of mourning. This is forced mourning on Joab, not because Joab is sincere or earning his money, but merely doing what David says. And David is mad enough, Joab's going to do whatever he says. He has to wear sackcloth. He has to mourn as if he were sincere in his mourning. On Joab's part, it's all a show. But some of you may remember a few years ago, there was a little film that showed a very high official in the United States government, who was walking along in a funeral procession. He was laughing, joking, and cutting up until he saw a camera on him. Then all of a sudden, he started wiping his eyes with tears that were fake tears. That's Joab. David is the first one in the funeral procession. He followed the bier. The others are after him, apparently. And then in 32, they buried Abner at Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, should Abner die as a fool dies? Hebron is the capital that David's been reigning in. He'll reign there for 7.5 years. And it's Abraham's burial place. He laments him, like in chapter 1, verse 17, he laments over Saul and Jonathan. Now he laments over Abner. His poem in verses 33 and 34, honor Abner. He asked the question, should Abner die as a fool dies? What in the world does that mean? Remember, their fool doesn't necessarily mean you don't have any brains, like we hear the word fool all the time. You don't know anything. But it's more the idea, here's a person who's a villain. Should you have been put to death? We would say, well, he died like a dog. And here's a great and noble, brave soldier. And yet he dies an ignoble death as though he were a criminal. And then in verse 34, your hands were not bound. You could have defended yourself with your hands. Your feet were not fettered. What would he do if his feet were fettered? He'd stand there and let him do it. But his feet weren't fettered. What should he have done? Run, right? And he says, as one falls before the wicked, you have fallen, and all the people wept again over him. So as David speaks and laments in this way, he says, you were free to defend yourself, you were free to escape, and you didn't either. You died as though you had been guilty of something, and you're willing to take your just deserts. And contrary to that, he was treacherously murdered for what David calls wicked men. Verse 35, all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. The sun hadn't set yet. But David swore, saying, God do so to me and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. So he's vowed not to eat till the sun goes down. All the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, get this, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So all the people in all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner the son of Ner. Bread here refers, eating bread, that's food in general. Give us this day our daily bread. Doesn't mean it's only Little Miss Sunbeam bag with bread in it, but whatever else constitutes food. And the sun, till the sun goes down, evening, as in chapter 1, verse 12. He did the same thing with Jonathan and Saul's lamentation. His fasting indicates the innocence on his part in the murder of Abner. He had nothing at all to do with it. Fasting is an indication of the deepest mourning, so David shows that. In verse 38, the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today. What a strange word. I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. Gentle here means gentle or tender or not harsh or not tough. In other words, weak, are soft or incapable, that is not able to complete a task, and so lacking governmental authority or power. Now, when the dictionaries tell you that something means what it means in this particular verse, they're assuming that they may be right and they may not be right. But when they give you the definition, you can almost always say that's going to be the case. Here, that's basically, in view of the context, I believe what's going on in this passage. David is being weak of heart, weak of mind. It's Deuteronomy 20, verse 8. Here's a man who's going out to war, and he's timid, he's gentle, he's tender, he's afraid. He says, send that man home. He'll cause a contagion to spread, and everybody will be discouraged and scared. It's used in 2 Chronicles 13, 7. Scoundrels defied a young, inexperienced Rehoboam who could not withstand him, it says. Here's a young, inexperienced Rehoboam, a few days on the job as king, and it uses this word. He's young and inexperienced. Zeruiah was probably David's half-sister, if I understand 1 Chronicles 2:16. That's up to debate, though. And then it says the Lord will repay Joab with just judgment. Any comments on any of these things? Steve?
You know, it kind of seems a little odd to why David didn't really execute Joab. He put pretty tough as far as that severe curse on where he's executed others, but he didn't even remove him from his position. I mean, Joab would continue to be David's right-hand man, if you will, as far as a general.
Exactly. You know, we wonder what goes on through David's mind. Is he saying, I'm in a precarious, brand new situation. Do I dare take a bold act this early in my career and will it ruin me? Is it because he's a relative of David, his sister's son? Is it because of some other reason? Maybe that he's such a great general? He's a sorry man, but in chapter 5, he's the one who rushes up through that water gap in Jerusalem and gets into the city and becomes the captain for sure at that point. I don't know. There's no justification for it as far as I can see. He deserved to die.
I guess you kind of got to think there must have been somewhat of a close relationship. They were close age-wise and this kind of thing. And perhaps even grew up together or knew each other a long time. And then contrasted with Solomon, he would know him. So he had a bit of a distance, a bit of a break. It's something that seems like it continued to bother David.
It did bother David. Yes. More than once he talks about... How long can I put up with you sons of Zeruiah? And I don't know how to explain it. He puts up with them, all right. But he doesn't approve of what they do, and yet he doesn't really do anything about it. He wants Solomon to handle it. So David, with some of the people he deals with, is like he was with his children. He was not a good father. He let his children get by with murder, rape, insurrection. Coup attempts, all this. And he's angry, upset with Joab and his men because the one who tries the hardest to kill him, they kill him. He was not a good father. 2 Kings 1:6 proves that very clearly. It just says it. So here's one who was so good at so many things, but he was not good as a father because he had no discipline and no ability to be consistent. But other than that, I really don't know the answer to that. Tim? Yeah. He deserved it. That's a very good point. Good parallel. Abner, no, he's trying to help David. And you have no reason to doubt his sincerity. Maybe you do, but you don't know it. Any others? Greg?
Yeah, his poem also seems to remind me, no, not with bonds or with fetters, that it was innocent.
It was innocent.
That he was innocent of this. Usually you have a person who's, you know, bound or fettered for some crime that he committed. This was not that. And also the deceitfulness of it. It was something that it was, he could have run away, but the fact of the matter is it was something that was done under deceit or under disguise.
It really was. It's the lowest kind of killing that you'll see. Any others? Okay. Well, what we would learn from this is don't be a Joab. 2 Samuel 4, I've titled this The Wrong Way to Get Ahead. In verse 1, it tells us when Saul's son heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost heart and all Israel was troubled. News about Abner's death didn't make Ishbosheth feel good. He didn't feel encouraged by it. In fact, he lost heart. He didn't say, well, that makes me once and for all the absolute monarch over the northern tribes. Rather, it just increased his instability and caused panic. And when it says here he lost heart, it literally says his hands dropped. His hands dropped. I don't know if this is like Hebrews 12, where it gives maybe the impression of a boxer who is so fatigued. What's the first thing that starts going besides his weak legs? He drops his hands. He can't hold his hands up anymore. And when he has his hands down, he can't defend himself. He's a sitting duck. He's a sitting boxer. So here's a man who's literally has his hand limp. He's lost. This is the dictionary definition of it. Lose courage, be discouraged, give up. Formerly, limp of hand, that is, have a feeling or attitude of hopelessness and lacking courage to resist an opponent. As a figurative extension of having a hand or arm being a very relaxed limp with no flexing of the muscle for action. And here again, they'll say, it means that in this verse. I happen to agree with that, but that's not always the case. It's just the point. So another one says, lose heart, lose energy. You know what it is to lose heart. Say, I just can't go on anymore. I just can't do this anymore. I'm too tired to fight. That's the way Ishbosheth is. Now, at that point where this man is too tired to fight, he is the one who has lost. The worst thing possible happens to him. Saul's son had two men who were captains of troops. The name of the one was Baanah, and the name of the other was Rechab, the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite of the children of Benjamin. And then it explains, parenthetically, for Beeroth was part of Benjamin because the Beerothites fled to Gittaim and have been sojourners there until this day. I can ask a lot more questions about that than I can answer. We know that Beeroth had been allied to Gibeon in Judges 9, 16 to 21. That much we know. It had been related to Gibeon. Beeroth is referred to in Joshua 18, 25. It seems to be part of Benjamin. And yet, part of the word, the etymology of the word, the history of the word, makes you think a Gittite is someone in the Philistine territory. So maybe that's a section of Benjamin where some live for some unknown reason. I don't know. I've said too much already. But in verse 4, Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened as she made haste to flee that he fell and became lame. His name was Mephibosheth. Okay, a couple of points about this. Why at this juncture does verse 4 bring up another son of Saul? What's the point? What's he developing here? What's the writer showing us?
There's another heir.
There's another heir, but what is his condition? Is he fit to reign?
He's helpless.
So here's a man named Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan. Jonathan, a good man. But he's lame. Originally, 1 Chronicles 8:34, his name was Meribbaal. Baal? Meribbaal, contender against Baal. But as was the case with some others, they oftentimes change their name, like Eshbaal becomes Ishbosheth. You don't want the name Baal in your name because of the connotations that may come up. It appears to be the reason. Mephibosheth appears later in chapter 9 as an object of David's mercy. So it comes out well for him. Then later when David's fleeing, I think he's probably lied against by Ziba the servant. So we'll get into that when it comes up. But Mephibosheth may be discussed here then to show that the death of Ishbosheth really leaves Saul's house without a ruler. Now think about that. We've reached the point in this history where Saul doesn't have anybody else to rule as king. Now, if you're an Israelite living in one of these northern tribes, and you hear about the death of Ishbosheth, and you know he is your last hope for any descendant of Saul to reign, what are you going to do? You going to go without a king? Going to go back to where it was where he had a king? Or are you going to go to the man whose reputation is known all over the world, who has defeated the Philistines one battle after another, who went up against Goliath? What are you going to do? Well, you're going to follow David. And that's really what takes place. So in verse 5, then the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Baanah, set out and came out about the heat of the day to the house of Ishbosheth. Now they come to his house, who was lying on his bed at noon. They took a siesta at that time. They didn't have very good air conditioning, typically. Everybody got a bit of time off during the hottest part of the day. Many of them would go lie on their bed and just take a nap or rest and try to get themselves rejuvenated. Start very early morning. They're tired at noon. They lie down for an hour. They get back up and go at it. So it says they came there, verse 6, all the way into the house, as though to get wheat. And they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baanah, his brother, escaped. For when they came into the house, he was lying on his bed in his bedroom. Then they struck him and killed him, beheaded him, and took his head. And all that they were all not escaping through the plain. They think this is the way to get ahead, and it's not. They're going to be killed because of this. Ishbosheth is a victim in his own house, lying on his own bed at midday at Machanaim that we've seen on the other side of the Jordan. The attackers choose a time when they know he's alone and defenseless and go in and just out murder, stab him in the stomach, Judges chapter 3, verse 27, with Abner earlier in 2:23 that we saw. This has been, 3 weeks ago, maybe? Abner stuck Asahel, the fast runner, and the brother of Joab and Abishai in the stomach, not wanting to, but ended up doing it. So you see, people are getting stuck in the stomach regularly here. That was their weapon of choice. They needed some kind of spear control, I suppose. But now in verse 8, they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, here's the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy. Yeah, we brought you a present. Look at this man's head. This is the king. Who's your rival? What a present we brought you. They think he's going to be so excited. He's Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life, and the Lord has avenged my Lord. God has really worked on your side today. Look what he's done. Well, murderers presume the Lord approves of their action, just like a lot of folks will do something, then they will presume, well, this is what the Lord led me to believe, this is what the Lord led me to do, and it's contrary to the word and the will of God all the way through. Even murderers do such things. And then he says, this is the Lord avenging my Lord. They assume David is going to approve. We have avenged you on what Saul did. Since when do you punish a child for the sins of a father? Where do we read anything like that in Scripture? What does it say? Where would you find it? Ezekiel 18:20? Did you have another?
Was it 33 also?
I think it is. 18 for sure. Probably in 33 too. I can't remember. 18:20 says, the soul who sins shall die. The son shall not bear the guilt of the father, nor the father bear the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous should be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked should be upon himself. This is all pretended piety. They don't understand David, and they certainly don't understand the Lord. Now, in verse 9, David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, and said to them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity, when someone told me, saying, look, Saul is dead, thanking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed in Ziklag, the one who thought I would give him a reward for his news. Where have we read about that before? Where would you find that? That incident there in verse 10. Where is that? Remember in chapter 1, this young Amalekite comes and he says, I brought you this bracelet and this other things that Saul wore. He was dying and he asked me to kill him, so I euthanized him, and here you go. You're the king. And he thought he'd get a reward, David says. He did that for the purpose of getting a reward. So David refers to that as sort of a legal precedent for what he's about to do now. In verse 11, how much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed. Therefore shall I not require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth. That expression, require his blood at your hand, recalls Genesis 9 verse 5. When God is showing the law of capital punishment, that was basically a creation principle stated after the flood. But he says, surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require, and from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. So if David wouldn't kill Saul, what makes anyone think he would kill his son, who's a righteous man, who never harmed David in any way? It makes no sense at all. Some people just don't think. And then he says, should I not require his blood at your hand? I'm going to hold you accountable for this. You've shed blood, therefore your blood must be shed. And then he says, I will remove you from the earth. Numbers 35:33 talks about what happens in a polluted land. How does a land get polluted? What was pollution back then? If some... Say it. You shed innocent blood and that land is polluted until you kill that person who shed that blood. Numbers 35:33. So verse 12. So David commanded these young men and they executed them, cut off their hands and feet, and hanged them by the pool in Hebron. I take that to be their hands and their feet is what they hung. It could be more, but at least that much. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner in Hebron. David repays them with death, mutilation, and public humiliation. Now, after their dead, he cuts off their hands. What had these hands done? They had slain an innocent man. What had these feet done? They had been swift to run to mischief, even to the point of shedding blood. They hung them up in public. David the king issues a warning. Look at what happens to people who murder a king. What lesson does he hope everybody's going to get from this? You kill a king and you're going to end up mutilated and publicly humiliated. Okay, any comments? Tim. Excellent, excellent comment. He could have rejoiced and said, well, I didn't actually pull the trigger, but boy, I'm glad they did. Nothing like that. Excellent point. Steve?
Case, it could be case two with these two guys. They said they were in the house of Ishbosheth too, and that when they heard of Abner, that killed him. It's possible they thought that David might sanction that. So now at the time, we've got to choose up our site because we're falling fast.
Wow, I hadn't thought of that either. Excellent. Yeah, very good. Ty?
Do you think that David learned, maybe I'm just missing this, where it was, do you think he learned later that the fellow that told him of Saul's death, do you think he learned later that he was lying? Because he says, he doesn't know that he claimed that he killed him, he just says he told me that he was dead. It's almost like he knows now that that was a lie, but you see what I'm saying?
Oh, in other words, did he find out that the Amalekite was just lying when he said, I killed Saul? I don't know.
Just the way he's worded this, it doesn't say that he claimed to kill him or anything like that, just said that he brought him news.
Yeah, and the only thing I'm really proved by it is that he thought he'd get a reward for that message. But I don't know. That's interesting. Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much for your help.